Writers After Hours. Afshan D'Souza Lodi is a bold creative determined to focus on joy in a world that still oppresses us in so many ways. Poet, script and playwright, Afshan's work has been performed and translated around the world. She took her one-woman show, How to Eat Mangoes, to Washington, D.C. in 2022. An honest and fun guest, Afshan started by telling me about the first novel she wrote as a teenager.
So it was like 40,000 words, I think, of absolute trash. again, based on some of my teachers, based on real life experiences. Actually, I wrote two novels. One of them was based on my teachers, and then one of them was based on my own life experiences. Mm-hmm. And then I converted that into a stage play, which then got on the Muslim Playwrights competition at Royal Exchange Theatre. Uh-huh. And that's where I truly, I think, began and really thought, oh, okay, I could do this properly. And and then I think they did a rehearsed reading of it with some actors. Afshan Azad was one of the actors that was performing from Harry Potter. So that was quite fun for me. Mm. And I think from there, I sort of really kind of started applying properly for programmes and diversity schemes and, getting involved with it that way.
Mm. Nice. And were there playwrights or television shows that kind of you were looking to, like, that inspired you?
Yeah, there were quite a few shows that inspired me growing up. The play that I remember really distinctly is Simon Stevens' Punk Rock, because it was the first play that I saw at the Royal Exchange Theatre. And midway through the play, one of the characters, who's a young student, holds a gun up to his classmate and he wees himself. He just pisses himself. And I remember watching it as a young person and being like, what? Like, is that possible? Like, how do you do that? Like, and, you know, trying to think of the mechanics of it. And there was just so much magic in that moment of, like, fear and intensity and also, like, humour, but also kind of, like, dark humour because he's holding a gun up to somebody else. That I think in my writing I've been trying to recreate that element, that moment of, like, magic. And then TV-wise, I remember watching the show Brits with Riz Ahmed. This is, like, oh, my God, like, early 2000s. And I remember being like, oh, no, my novel is very similar to this idea and being really irritated that I hadn't published the novel as, like, a 16-year-old and being, like, really offended that, like, the BBC, I think it was BBC, had, like, put this show out that was basically my idea. And obviously, they'd copied it. But I think, yeah, I think growing up, like, I was really influenced by a lot of South Asian poets and writers and musicians, watching Bollywood, growing up watching Indian TV dramas were really, like, that was the thing that got me through life. And I think in some way, shape or form, I've always been trying to recreate the magic that I got from seeing those shows and reading those materials.
Nice. So, you've gone from the Royal Exchange to all the way to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
with your show, How to Eat Mangoes. How did that come about and how was the experience?
Yeah, so How to Eat Mangoes has been a really strange one. Mm-hmm. Initially, the idea came about when my debut poetry collection, RE Desire, was being published. And within it, I've got a poem talking about how the South Asian diaspora clings onto a mango as a sort of, like, way of trying to understand culture. And it's supposed to be, like, a bit of a piss take. It's supposed to be quite ironic, playing on, like, Salman Rushdie's idea of, like, mangoes being something that the diaspora clings to. And I thought, as a way of promoting the book, I would write a play. I'd write a one-person show called How to Eat Mangoes and play with this idea. Unfortunately, COVID happened that same year, which meant that I couldn't take the show out. And at the same time, I joined Georgetown University's Performance and Politics Lab with nine other brilliant theatre makers, performers and academics from across the world. And they really encouraged me to play with joy and with fun. And also have politics in it, but, like, to a lesser extent. I think my focus throughout 2020 to 2023 has been around joy. And not just in the process, but also in the product and what we create. And so How to Eat Mangoes became very much about this idea of how do we explore joy in a world where everything is set up to make us feel like shit so that it can sell us stuff in a world that's very capitalist. How do we say no to that and support each other and really take care of each other? I think that show did quite well in DC. I brought it to the UK as well quite recently. And then the BFI last year gave me some funding to turned that idea into a feature film. So I've been working on that for the past year.
Okay.
I've got a treatment ready. So if there's any producers listening that are interested in that idea, come hit me up on Twitter or email. Ideally, I'd love to turn it into something. I think it's got legs of some sort.
Mm. I recently saw it as part of Bisexual Baddies. And it's a lot of fun. Actually, with that show, it's kind of, you got the sensual element, and how's it been for you, like, exploring your sensuality and sexuality through your creative work, you know? Like, have you felt, like, nervous about that, or, you know, afraid as, like, a Muslim woman, you know?
Yeah, all the above. I think for me, growing up, I was always, I wouldn't say obsessed with sex, but I think it was always something that came up in a lot of my work as maybe it's because of the taboo that was associated with
it.
And I think, you know, mangoes are also such an erotic fruit, as are pomegranates. And there was something for me about how, as a diaspora, we cling on to something, but also then have this taboo around sex and sexuality, which is part of the colonial hangover. It's, you know, for me, it's this prudishness that I think a lot of South Asians still have clung onto for decades has been because of British colonialism coming in and shifting how we view ourselves and how we view sexuality. So part of sort of taking ownership of sensuality, sexuality, eroticism has been a sort of like F you to colonialism and like decolonizing myself within that process. Like, my mum, bless her, like, she read some of my early work and was like, why do you keep writing about sex? Like, maybe write about, like, me or something that's kind of fun. And I have done. I've done poetry around my mum and written work that's very much, like, you know, wholesome and family. But I think I always keep coming back to this innate idea that, and I think it was Oscar Wilde quote, that everything in the world is about sex apart from sex, which is about power. And just kind of, like, feeding back to that and reclaiming something that I think is taken away and from a lot of South Asian women particularly.
So if, because there are many still kind of like, I mean, oppressions that we as, you know, as writers of colour still experience, you know, one of them, one topic of that being sexuality and sensuality. So like, what advice would you give to like an emerging writer who kind of wants to explore these topics, but kind of feel scared, feel shame even about wanting to write about those things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard thing to try to grapple with, especially when you're coming out as a new writer or emerging as a writer, particularly because I think, and things are shifting a little bit society-wise, but so much of the writing industry is about the white gaze and about how the white Western capitalist publishers or industry views you as a woman of colour or a South Asian woman or a Muslim woman. And often we fall into stereotypes. So either we desexualize ourselves and play into this submissive Muslim woman, you know, South Asian woman trope. Or in order to like counter that, you know, to counter the stereotype, we hypersexualize ourselves and almost like play into the white gaze and you know, exoticize ourselves in that way. And I think so long as we're aware of both of those sides and really understanding of why we're creating the stuff that we're creating, you know, that's something that, that's helped me. Early on in my career, I used to write under a pseudonym. So a lot of my queer stuff, a lot of my stuff that was very much centering the erotic and centering the sexual identities were under a different name. And I've used two different names in the past. And that was a way for me to... And, you know, Rosie Lagosi, Rosie Garland does it as well with her pseudonym, is that it allowed me to really explore another side of myself and almost create a persona that then wouldn't come back to me necessarily. So I could be as like queer and sexual and weird as I wanted to in this other space as Tara Ali Din and then come back to myself as Afshan de Sousa Lodhi and write, you know, the other stuff. And obviously as time's gone on, I haven't needed that other pseudonym as much and I don't even use Tara at all anymore. But, you know, it was nice that I had the opportunity to do that and not have to, like, completely out myself in every situation, but have another identity that could take the criticism, I guess, from people if, the, you know, if there was any.
So almost, like, being okay with, like, different ways you can help yourself and kind of, facilitate your own creative process. So whether it's a pseudonym or... So that's interesting.
You know, women have been doing writing under anonymous and under male names for centuries. It's not a new thing. Unfortunately, it's not a new thing. And I think the society will always criticize us for being women and for, you know, regardless of whether we're brown women or South Asian women or Muslim women. So whatever we can do to protect ourselves within that, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be looked down upon to have a pseudonym or to write under anonymous. I think it's definitely a really powerful thing. And particularly with the politics of what's going on in the world now, it almost feels like sometimes in order to say the things that are really necessary, we need to protect ourselves and protect our identity.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it's not like a failure on our part. It's exactly. it's like so it's a reflection of the reality that we live
100%.
In. 100%. So, yeah, you mentioned your collection, RE Desire.
Yes.
I mean, all the brilliant work you've done, what are you most proud of?
I think I get asked this question a lot, and every time I get asked it, I change my answer.
Okay, okay.
So right now, I guess I'm most proud of, there's a stage play that I'm writing called Chop Chop, about four Muslim women working in a halal butcher shop, and a murder takes place, or they accidentally murder somebody. Let's make it active. They accidentally murder somebody, and then they have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a comedy drama. It looks at loyalty within women, what it means to be in a women's only space, what happens when the patriarchy in the form of a white inspector comes in and sort of challenges that space. How does that work? How does the dynamic of the women work together? And for me, it's been, I think, weirdly, my most successful piece. It's the piece people like to see a lot of. There's been a monologue version of it. There's been a radio play version of it. The TV pilot version got on the Muslim list last year and is currently being, you know, in developed with producers. The stage play is being produced with Royal Exchange Theatre. So it feels like it's a story that people are really resonating with for whatever reason. And it's just funny. And I wrote it to have fun. And it's become a bit political since then. I've done a lot of work developing it. But for me, I think it's being able to have four Muslim women of different racial backgrounds and identities and ethnicities come together and be able to have conversations about liberalness, conservatism, feminism, you know, even like Andrew Tate, for example, within a safe environment, and use comedy as a lens to do that. I think that, for me, that's my most proudest work.
Wonderful.
At the moment, anyway. Ask me again in a week's time and it'll be a different answer.
No, that's great. With the various commissions that you get, how do you kind of manage to stay feeling creative and free? And do you have kind of your, like a ritual, or kind of how do you maintain your kind of, you know, your internal space of being creative?
I used to, quite a few years ago, do morning pages. So wake up in the morning and spend a certain amount of time writing. I haven't done that in a few years. And I've been quite privileged in that a lot of the programs that I've been part of allow me to write without being attached to a commission.
Okay.
More recently anyway. I think there was a time when everything I was writing was being attached to a commission. And I think it's getting closer to that right now. But I think it's about finding, for me, it's about finding space and finding people to hold accountability with. So I've got a lot of friends that I share scripts with, and they share with me. And, you know, we give each other deadlines. And it's a good way of, you know, for my ADHD brain to have a deadline to be able to stick to. You know, so I'm also creating stuff, but also it's not being prescribed by a theatre or by a production company, because it's not attached to anybody. So I'm allowed to write whatever comes to me and explore the stories and the characters in whatever way I want to. I'm always writing something that I shouldn't be writing, because I should be writing the commissioned thing. So it feels a bit naughty sometimes, and I feel a bit guilty about it, but it's fun. Like, I'm not going to stop. There'll always be something I'm writing that I shouldn't be writing and focusing on something else. And that's where the, you know, Chop Chop came out from that. Chop Chop I was writing when I was supposed to write another play. And, you know, and then it became, and it is becoming now a commissioned piece multiple different ways. And now there's other stuff that I'm writing when I should be writing Chop Chop. So it's like, there's always going to be a cycle.
So it's almost, again, like not like judging yourself or holding yourself back. It's like, whenever the creativity is flowing, even if it's, you know, something you shouldn't be doing.
But then as well as that, like, I think I'm fully freelance as a writer now. So I have to make sure that I take my job, which is writing, as seriously. So it is kind of going, okay, 9 to 5, we're going to work. Do it as a work day. Or, you know, 10 to 4, whatever it is. Have a lunch break in between. Take days off and really treat it as if I was due to go to an office. And I think sometimes we rely on this this idea of like the inspiration will strike when it strikes. And it takes us 20 years to write a book or a play. And I think it's because we're not taking ourselves seriously. I think we have the ideas and we have all the words within us. It's about setting down a schedule mm-hmm. and treating it as seriously. Mm. And sometimes it's that fear of, you know, we're unsure of ourselves and we're scared that it's not going to be the best work and mm. we don't want to be judged for it. So we don't put 100% of our energy and effort into it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we're doing ourselves a disservice through that.
Yeah, and maybe scared of like investing time exactly. for something that maybe doesn't come out perfect, you
That's
know?
That's it. But then I'd ask you, like, why are you making that stuff that you're creating? You know, who yeah. is it for? Mm-hmm. And I think first and foremost, it should be for yourself. Mm-hmm. And then it should be for X, Y, and Z. And, you know, once you've got your audiences figured out, mm-hmm. hopefully that should give you a bit of a boost as to why you're creating and mm. help you wake up in the morning and go, okay, I'm going to put my clothes on and make a cup of tea and then start by 9 o'clock, mm. you know, sit at a desk or find a hot desking space or, you know, I go to cafes with my friends and we hold each other to account with mm. that, take a lunch break, you know, gossip in between as we would do if we were in the office.
Yeah,
take
yeah,
a break,
yeah.
go out for a drink or a coffee afterwards. You know, you've got to treat it like a proper job.
Yeah. And like with any job, it's like you have to, yeah, keep in mind your purpose and like, you know, your goal and, exactly. Yeah, like you said, your audience as well and who you're writing for. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about creative community mm-hmm. Because I know you travel a bit with like your work that you do, yeah. And yeah, how's it been creating communities? Because you've mm-hmm. set up like various initiatives mm-hmm. in Manchester and maybe beyond. I'm not aware of yet, but for example, Words with Friends, mm-hmm. and you know, you've got the network that you do through Home in Manchester. Yeah. So, how do you find that process? And then, how do you kind of keep that alive when you're traveling and mm-hmm. you know can maybe feel a bit. Traveling can be isolating, you know, and going into completely new spaces. Yeah.
So writing for me can be quite an isolating thing.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing that I've done is join collectives and groups and start collectives and groups.
Yeah.
And it's been a way to keep me accountable, but mm. also to help us find funding, to support each other. Often, I mean, maybe it's not a good thing, but we always create a WhatsApp group. Back in the day, it used to be mm-hmm. Facebook, but we don't use Facebook in that same way anymore. So it's WhatsApp groups now that we create. And I've got groups from like, you know, Tamasha, which was like, what, 2016, 2017? Mm. You know, and we're still in communication with each other and sharing our opportunities and mm. talking about the good things that we're in. And for me, the reason that I write is for community, is to not feel so alone in the world and to help other people not feel so alone. Mm. So the creation of groups and networks feels really, really important. Mm-hmm. Even if I'm going and I'm not writing in those spaces, but I'm talking about writing or being with people who can support me and send me opportunities or I can send them opportunities, mm. it's all fulfilling and it's all feeding into my creative engine in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we discount that as a thing and we kind of go, oh, you're socializing. But I think as a writer, I need to be socializing. I need to be meeting people mm-hmm. because those are the people that are eventually going to make their way in some way, shape or form as characters or stories into the stuff that I'm writing.
Yeah.
Because I want my work to be reflective of people that exist right now.
Yeah, and maybe probably makes the process of writing more dynamic, you know?
Exactly.
So that you're not just, you know, you get that motivation, you're spurred on by knowing there's other people doing it and that, yeah, you can then potentially go and share and get feedback from
A lot of my work is co-written, is you mm-hmm. know, I've got five projects, I think, that are collaborative projects with other writers. And all those writers I've met through different screens and programs. Mm. One person I met on a podcast mm-hmm. and we hit it off and I was like, great, let's write a show together. And we've written one show together and we're starting a second show.
Nice.
And for me, you know, there's always, collaboration is really key in everything that I do, mm-hmm. whether it's writing or working in a, you know, in an office. Mm. I think there's something really powerful about people coming together and bringing their ideas in and then mm-hmm. as working out a way forward collectively and collaboratively. So mm-hmm. I'll always be doing that. And I think being part of networks, and if those networks don't exist, creating my own network until they do exist and they become mainstream is the way forward. Mm-hmm. You know, me and Adam in 2012.
So Adam Lowe.
Adam Lowe, yes. Mm-hmm. Created Young Enigma, which was a group for young LGBT writers in Manchester and in the mm-hmm. North specifically. And that was because we noticed that a few of the initiatives that are Northern focused had dropped down. Mm. And we ran that and it still exists as an entity right now. We don't mm-hmm. necessarily do events in the same way, but, mm-hmm. you know, we were the first writers in residence for LGBT History Month. We went to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of performances across the North and also, you know, in the UK. And I think for me, it was about creating a network and a safe space for people, A, to talk about their work, regardless of their, without having to address their identity in that way,
yeah.
if they didn't want to. And B was an access to get funding for us. And though that group doesn't exist in that way, there's been friendships and networks that we've built. And then since then, thankfully, there've been lots more networks and opportunities that have opened up for young queer writers. So we don't need Young Enigma in that same way. It's not necessity, you know. What is needed maybe now is one particularly for writers of colour, for queer writers of colour, for example, maybe a networking space. But, and you know, thankfully, one of the good things out of COVID has been that this move to online means that things are a bit more accessible for us.
Yeah.
So there probably are queer writer of colour networks that can exist online and that have been existing. I know Commonweal does a book group as well.
Book club, yeah.
So, you know, there's different initiatives and stuff coming out now. So my work isn't needed in that way.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I helped create those, but, you know, there's something about if there isn't one existing, we kind of gone, right, let's just put it together and do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. Try and find some money or find a venue that can give us a free hire space.
Yeah.
Until we can find money or until we can find other ways to support ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. So it kind of sounds like it doesn't need to be something complicated. It's just you have the idea and... Yeah, you just need one person to agree to, you know, help you and if you know that, if you sense that there's like a need or an interest in that, then because it can be daunting, like, oh, I'm going to set up my own group, I'm going to set up things, but 100%. It's how you're describing it, I'm like, oh, actually, it doesn't need to be that.
No, I think the key thing is consistency.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Identity Writers Group, you'll know that like Wednesday evenings, you know, they've been running for like since the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I was part of them and it's... You know, and sometimes I remember when I was running them, I'd turn up and there might be nobody there.
Mm.
But just the act of being there
and
writers knowing that every Wednesday evening you could turn up and there would be a Identity Group unless it was Christmas or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people built trust with that.
Yeah.
And they knew that they could then come in and they didn't have to come every single time. And I think the thing that we sometimes disservice ourselves with is by kind of going, oh, we have to meet X amount, you know, we're going to meet once every month, for example, and then we don't meet that month, and then we don't meet the next month, and then suddenly it dies down.
You need to, you know, and I think
sometimes just two people meet up. It doesn't have to be every single one of you in that collective or the group that come together.
Yeah.
But it's a space that you're creating and consistency for yourself as well, taking yourself seriously, taking everybody else's time seriously as well within that space.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm absorbing this. It's for me and the listeners.
I love that.
You mentioned yourself like attending Identity Writers Group and probably like co-facilitating as well whilst you were working at Common Word. So just wanted to end on Common Word question, which is what does your experience with the organisation mean to you both, like, In your working life, creative life,
Common Word politicised me. Mm-hmm. I came to Manchester I'm from Manchester, but I did my degree in London, and I came back to Manchester as a 21-year-old, thinking I knew everything that was going to happen in the world. I did philosophy for my undergrad, so obviously I had all the answers. And I think I came in and had no. I think I understood racism, and I understood some of the issues, but I didn't really understand the historical context.
Mm.
And I thought this was a new thing that we were talking about. And I think joining Common Word really allowed me to understand the history of activism, particularly in Manchester, through writing and resistance through writing in a way that I think I wouldn't have done otherwise had I not joined the organisation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came in, I did Black Writers Conference in 2013.
Mm.
You know, that was insane. Like, to come in and run a conference as my first like proper job was, I have no idea how Pete trusted me with that, but you know, he did, and here we are.
He has good instincts.
But I think it definitely allowed me access into a world of writing and creativity and really thinking about development seriously. And it's something that I've taken with the rest of my work. So even though I'm fully freelance and I write, I always mentor writers.
Mm.
I'm always running development programs or advising and consulting with organizations to make sure that they are more diverse and being more accessible to newer and emerging writers. So Common Word gave me that access point. It gave me that context to be able to, it gave me the wording to be able to contextualize my own life and my own identity within a new writing or publishing or any other form. So I think I have a good relationship with Common Word.
I mean, we love you, so.
Thanks.
Thank you you so much, Afshan. It's been really lovely chatting with you. And best of luck for your next ventures.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Here's this episode's writing prompt. Write about a character confronting a taboo. This is a Culture Word production. Thank you to our funders, The Space and Arts Council England, recorded at Silver Lining Music Studio.